Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm David Hellman, Collection Development Coordinator, Librarian, and faculty member at San Francisco State University's J. Paul Leonard Library. I'm also a book reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle and a member of the Commonwealth Club's California Book Awards jury. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We have a very special program this evening. Since 1974, when at the age of 24 he published his first novel, The Wanderers, Price has become one of the essential literary voices for the contemporary urban experience, with all of its gritty contradictions and complexities. The Wanderers was followed in short order by Blood Brothers, Ladies' Man, and The Breaks, novels that continued to solidify his reputation as a writer. For a while, it seemed like we readers had lost Price to Hollywood. But our loss as readers became a gain for those of us who loved movies. Starting in 1986, Price brought his screenwriting talents to such films as The Color of Money, for which he received an Oscar nomination, New York Stories, Sea of Love, Night and City, and who could forget Michael Jackson's music video Bad. Then in 1992, Price published a novel called Clockers, which focused on many of the themes that had informed his earlier work, but also took him in a new direction and, in a way, reinvented him as an author. It was both a huge critical and commercial success. Clockers was then followed by two other excellent novels, Freedom Land and Samaritan, in what is often referred to as the Dempsey Trilogy. Now, despite this sizable literary output, Price has continued to write for the screen and has worked on films such as Mad Dog and Glory, Kiss of Death, Ransom, and adaptations of his own novels, Clockers and Freedomland. Price has also been a writer for the HBO television series The Wire, which had its series finale just a few weeks ago. Most recently, Richard Price has published a remarkable new novel, Lush Life, which I have to agree with many critics may be his best book. This novel brings Price back to New York City after a lengthy residence in New Jersey for his last three novels and deals with the clash of classes and cultures in a city whose history and identity and diversity are threatened by gentrification and the glittery yet blurred aspirations of a new generation of inhabitants. Please help me welcome Richard Price.
Thank you.
Richard's actually going to start off by doing a short reading for us, and then I'm going to start some questions, and then later in the program I'll take the audience questions.
All right. The first one's going to be real short. It's just, 55 pages. This book's about the Lower East Side, which in part at this point in history of the book, 2003, has become sort of like a La Boheimer playground, although there are about five other worlds down there that would beg to differ. It went from the worst precinct in New York to just about the safest. And as one critic said, the cops have become more or less park rangers. But the problem is if you're a precinct commander and you live in a very safe area and you work in a very safe area, it looks to one police plaza like you're not doing any work when you turn in your numbers. So they instituted a squad called the Quality of Life Squad, and their job is to basically go out and provoke arrests. I don't know how else to put it. And what these guys do is there are four guys in plain clothes, about 900 pounds of white meat, with guns, sitting in a taxi that's supposed to fool people, and they sit on Delancey Street as the so they get the traffic coming over from Brooklyn over the Williamsburg Bridge, and they just racially profile pretty much. And what I'm going to read is a typical adventure of the Quality of Life Squad looking for business. And there are four guys in this squad. Their names are Lugo, Daly, Gahagan, and Scharf. And there are two kids that they pull over, and their names are Seriously and Fucked. They said it was okay to say stuff like that. So now they're prowling in this taxi. They're just trolling, looking for they're night fishing. Hang on. Scharf abruptly perks up, his head on a swivel. That there looks good. High beams going west. Four bodies. Going west? Lugo floors it in heavy traffic. Think thin, girls. As he takes the driver's side wheels up onto the concrete divider to get past a real cab waiting for the light, then whips into a U-turn to get abreast of the target car, peering in. Females, two mommies, two kids, passing them, hungrier now, all of them. Then Scharf ahoying once again. Green Honda going east. Now east, he says. Lugo does another 180 and pulls behind the Honda. What do we got? Two males in the front. What do we got? Neon trim on the plate. Tinted windows. Right rear taillight. Front passenger just stuffed something under the seat. Thank you. Lugo hits the misery lights, climbs up the Honda's back, the driver taking a half a block to pull over. Daly and Lugo slowly walk up on either side of the car, cross-beam the front seats. The driver, a young green-eyed Latino, rolls down his window. Officer, what'd I do? Lugo rests his cross arms on the open window as if it's a backyard fence. License and registration, please. For real, what'd I do? You always drive like that? His voice almost gentle. Like what? Signaling lane changes, all road courteous and shit? Excuse me? Come on, nobody does that unless they're nervous about something. Well, I was. Nervous? You was following me. A cab was following you? Yeah, okay, a cab. Passing over his papers. All serious, officer, and no disrespect intended. Maybe I can learn something here, but what did I do? Primary, you have neon trim on your plates. Hey, I didn't put it there. This my sister's whip. Secondary, your windows are too dark. I told her about that. Tertiary, you crossed a solid yellow. To get around a double parked car. Quadrary, you're sitting by a hydrant. That's because you just pulled me over. Lugo takes a moment to assess the level of mouth he's getting. As a rule, he is soft-spoken, leaning into the driver's window to conversate, to explain, his expression baggy with patience, going eye to eye as if to make sure what he's explicating here is being digested, seemingly deaf to the obligatory sputtering, the misdemeanors of verbal abuse. But if the driver says that one thing, goes one word over some invisible line, then without any change of expression, without any warning signs except maybe a slow straightening up, a sad, disgusted looking off, he steps back, reaches for the door handle, and the world as they knew it is no more. But this kid isn't too bad. This is for your own benefit. Get out of the car, please. As Lugo escorts the driver to the bumpers, Daly leans into the shotgun seat window and tilts his chin at the passenger. The second kid sitting there affecting comatosity, heavy-lidded under a too big baseball cap and staring straight ahead as if they were still driving somewhere. So what's your story, Daly says, opening the passenger door, offering this one some sidewalk too. As Gahagan, all tatted out in Celtic braids, knots, and crosses, leans in to search the glove compartment, the cup caddy, the tape storage bin, Scharf taking the rear seats. Back at the bumpers, the driver stands in a scarecrow tee, looking off soul-eyed as Lugo squinting through his own cigarette smoke, finger walks his pockets, coming up with a fat roll of 20s. It's a lot of cheddar, cuz. Counting it, then stuffing it in the kid's shirt pocket before continuing to pat down. Yeah, well, that's my college tuition money. What the fuck? College takes cash, Lugo laughs, then finished gestures to the bumper. Have a seat. Burke Technical in the Bronx? It's new. And they take cash? Money's money. True that, Lugo shrugs, just waiting out the car search. So what's your major? Furniture management? You ever been locked up before? Come on, man, my uncle's like a detective in the Bronx. Like a detective? No, a detective. He just retired. Oh, yeah, what precinct? I don't know, per se. The 69th? The fighting 69th, Gahagan calls out, feeling under the passenger seat now. There is no 69th, Lugo says, flicking his butt into the gutter. 60-something, I said I wasn't sure. What's his name? Rodriguez? Rodriguez in the Bronx? That narrows it down. What's his first name? Narciso? Don't know him. Had a big retirement party? Sorry. I've been thinking of trying out for the police academy myself. Oh, yeah, that's great. Hey, Donnie, Gehagen backs out of the passenger door, holds up a Ziploc of weed, because we need more smoke hounds. The kid closes his eyes, tilts his chin to the stars, to the moon over Delancey. His or yours? Lugo gestures to the other kid on the sidewalk, face still blank as a mask, his pockets strewn over the car hood. Somebody needs to say, or you both go. Mine, the driver finally mutters. Turn around, please. Oh, you gonna lock me up for that? Hey, 2 seconds ago you stepped up like a man. Stay with that. Lugo cuffs him, then turns him forward again, holding him at arm's length as if to assess his outfit for the evening. Anything else in there? Tell us now. We'll rip that hoopty to shreds. Damn, man, I barely had that. All right, then just relax. Guiding him back down to the bumper as the search continues nonetheless. The kid looks off, shakes his head, mutters, sorry, ass. Excuse me? No, I'm just saying, purse in his mouth, not about you. Gehagen comes back with the bag. He hands it over. Okay, look. Lugo lights another cigarette, takes a long first drag. This? We could give a damn. We're out here on a higher calling. He nods at a passing patrol car, something the driver said, making him laugh. You know what I'm saying? More serious shit? There you go. That's all I got. I'm not talking about what you got. I'm talking about what you know. What I know? You know what I'm saying. They both turn and look off in the direction of the East River, two guys having a moment, one with his hands behind his back. Finally, the kid exhales heavily. Well, I can tell you where a weed spot is. You're kidding me, right? Lugo rears back. I'll tell you where a weed spot is. I'll tell you where 50 is. I can get you better shit than this for half what you paid 7 days a week with blindfolds on. The kid sighs, tries not to look at the barely curious locals coming out of the Banco de Ponce ATM Center and the Dunkin' Donuts, the college kids hopping in and out of taxis. Come on, do right by me, I'll do right by you. Lugo absently tosses the baggie from hand to hand, drops it, picks it up. Do right like how? I want a gun. A what? I don't know a gun. You don't have to know a gun, but you know someone who knows someone, right? Oh, man. For starters, you know who you bought this shit from, right? I don't know any gun, man. You got $40 of weed there. I paid for it with my own money because it helps me relax, helps me party. Everybody I know is like, go to work, go to school, get high, that's it. Huh. So, like, there's no one you could call and say, yo, I just got jacked in the PJs. I need me a one-time whistle. Can I meet you at such and such? A whistle? Lugo makes a finger gun. Oh, you mean a hammer? A hammer, a whistle. Lugo turns away and tightens his ponytail. The kid looks off then. I know a knife. Lugo laughs. My mother knows a knife. This one's used. Forget it. Then chin tilting to the other kid. What about your sidekick there? My cousin? He's like half retarded. How about the other half? Ah, come on. The driver lolls his head like a cow. Another patrol car rolls up, this one to pick up the prisoner. All right, just think about it, okay? Lugo says, I'll see you back in holding in a few hours. What about my car? Gilbert Grape there, he's got a license? His brother does. Well, then tell him to call his brother and get his ass down here before you wind up towed. Damn. And calling out, Raymond, you hear that? The cousin nods, but makes no move to retrieve his cell phone from the car hood. So you never answered my question, Lugo says, skull steering him into the rear of the cruiser. You ever been locked up before? The kid turns his head away, murmurs something. It's okay, you could tell me. I said yes. For? The kid shrugs, embarrassed, says, this? Yeah, around here? Uh-huh. How long back? On Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve for this? Lugo winces. That is cold. Who the fuck? Do you remember who collared you? Uh-huh. The kid mutters, then looks Lugo in the face. You. Damn.
Thank you.
Sorry.
First of all, I wanted to say that most of my questions that I'm going to ask, and I'll get some questions from the audience building up here, are going to be about your literary works. And I want to encourage people for the audience who are interested in what Richard's done with movies and particularly with The Wire to write those down and pass them up. I can ask some questions, but I don't have much. And I have to confess, I must be one of the few people in this country that has never seen The Wire. So, I know. I tried once, but you know, it's one of those series that if you don't watch it from the first episode, I think I watched the second episode of the first season, said forget about this, and then I actually tried to start watching it this season, said oh really, forget about it, and then Netflix failed me recently. So what can I say? So if people have questions related to that that they're interested in, please pass them forward. I'll be happy to ask Richard about them. Now the quality of life patrol. First thing I wanted to ask you about that is it's very interesting. It's sort of, they appear periodically in the novel. They have almost, to some effect, it's sort of a perverse way, a comic relief. And there's this sparring back and forth between the people who are pulled over, and I find it very interesting. They're usually pulled over for doing the correct thing, like doing a proper turn signal or something like that, because anybody who does the correct thing is obviously doing something wrong. But can you talk a little bit about that repartee that goes between the police and the people that they're pulling over, and maybe that element of comedy that you're bringing out of these scenes?
Well, you got to understand, like I said, law enforcement, like so many things, it's a numbers game, and you just got to look busy. And obviously, in some more active precincts, they wouldn't bother doing stupid stuff like this. It's like it is what it is. It's night fishing. But even in a perfectly safe precinct, you got to look to one police plaza like you're busy. At one point, they were so strung out for a collar that they picked up an 80-year-old Chinese guy for doing Tai Chi 5:30 in the morning in a public park, which didn't open until 6 a.m., so he was trespassing. And, you know, in all fairness, those guys got kicked out of the precinct, you know, but for the day. But, I mean, the whole point of the banter, this whole notion, it's what always amazes me when I go out on the street and I see anything that involves opposing sides, like, you know, criminals or and police, is the amount of negotiation and small talk. I mean, they're very familiar with each other, and everybody, I've never seen anybody get hot and bothered. Sometimes, you know, somebody will get freaked out that they got stopped, and but by and large, the nature of the contact between people on the street, it's like, what I do, you know? It's like, so what's your major? You know, but it's always like that, it feels, and it's like, it's like the theme. It's like AA. It's like the big motto is easy does it, you know? Nobody wants a fight, you know, either side. And a lot of times in the smaller towns, everybody knows everybody. You know the bad guys. You went to high school with the bad guys. You see them every day. It's exhausting to, like, gnash your teeth at them and vice versa. And, I mean, that's one thing that draws me to this stuff is to document the negotiations, the everydayness of it.
I mean, it's an uneven relationship, but in some ways they're playing it kind of evenly. I mean, it seems like the police have, you know, almost a respect for the game that they're playing.
Well, they know what they're not fooling anybody, including themselves. I mean, one guy even said to me, you know, Mr. Price, which I hate, Mr. Price, marijuana paid my mortgage. You know, it's like, you know, look, if they were posted up in Washington Heights, they would not be doing this, you know. The book itself is basically about a place, the Lower East Side, which, you know, historically, you pretty much know what the Lower East Side is. It's the most important neighborhood in American history, I'd say. You know, but after the Eastern European, you know, you just land there, get off the boat from Ellis Island, you land on Lower East Side, you look around, you say, I got to get out of here. And it caused 50 years of frantic success, you know, just to get the hell out of that place. And since, I'd say, the World War II years, it's become a rougher and rougher place. And by the 60s and 70s, it was just a heroin market. And then, like I said, when Giuliani came in and imposed Giuliani time, which means lock anybody, if somebody so much as lights up a menthol cigarette, lock them up, combined with real estate needing a place to go. Real estate is the greatest crime fighter ever. And also, real estate is violence. I mean, and overnight, this place almost became like a Hipparati destination. You know, it's like everybody thought they were in Montparnasse. If it was 1974 and I was in my early 20s and wanting to be a writer, I'd crawl on broken glass to get to the Lower East Side, you know, the way it is. The problem is that all these kids there and all this elevated rent and all this real estate and this you know, gushing up of high-rises, you know, all these kids, they're oblivious to the fact that you have six housing projects. You've got the tenements that haven't been touched by real estate yet. The lava flows from north to south, stops at Delancey. It's a big divide. So, you know, you got places that tenements were mostly black and Hispanic and Chinese and geezer hippie. You know, so you got that. You got the Orthodox Jews. You got this enormous population of Fujianese Chinese, a lot of them of which are undocumented. And they're living just like the Jews lived in the Jacob Riis era. I mean, you know, 22 an apartment, every penny is like blood money and goes home or goes to the snakehead that got him over here. You know, there's about six universes there. And everybody is kind of oblivious to everybody else. There's no hostility, but the Chinese don't see the kids. The kids don't see the blacks. The blacks don't see the Orthodox Jews. The Orthodox Jews don't see the Hispanics, except maybe like 2, 3 in the morning, a couple of kids from the projects will walk over to, you know, the Zagat area and, you know, flash a gun at, you know, two kids from the Midwest that had just moved in, they're bar hopping, and they say, you know, give me the money. And what happens is these kids that are getting a gun in their face, they're not street smart, they've never had a gun put in their face, they're drunk. And one kid will do the Desmond Morris thing, you know, put your head down, you know, and give him the wallet, don't look, so he knows you can't ID him in a lineup, you know, just do the whole survival thing. But the other kid will all of a sudden flash back to some John Wayne movie he saw or Billy Jack or something, you know, and he'll say something stupid or he'll step to the gun, you know, and a trigger is pulled. You have 5 days of headlines. Everybody's favorite, the media, their favorite victim is young, aspiring artists coming to New York with stars in their eyes, gunned down on the cold streets of Manhattan. I mean, they love that stuff. And media is the tail that wags the police dog. The police will respond all hands on deck to anything that hits the papers in a big way. So the whole Lower East Side will get turned upside down for 5 days. And on day six, everybody will go back to their respective universes like nothing happened. And the book is about a homicide that takes place under those. It's like a robbery gone stupid and tragic. And that's the center. And the reason why I picked the homicide is I don't particularly feel like I'm a crime writer, although I just sort of feel like this world is so Byzantine that, you know, a crime investigation is a lazy man's way through a plot. You know, you just follow the investigation, and in a very orderly way, it will take you forward and forward and forward, and it'll touch on the Chinese, and it'll touch on the Eurotrash, and it'll touch on the Orthodox, and it, you know, just follow that thing through. It's a very, very good horse to ride through a very hilly terrain.
I want to ask another question about the quality of life, but you brought up something that's been a question on my mind for a while. You say you don't particularly think of yourself as a crime writer, and I've asked myself repeatedly, you know, would you think of yourself as a genre writer, and how do you distinguish yourself as not? And I definitely don't think of you as a genre writer. I've actually had conversations with people where we've gotten into debates about it. I said, no, there's a different sort of literary standard. It doesn't necessarily follow the formulas that are sort of written in genres. So can you talk a little bit to that?
That you basically hit on the key word, which is formula. I mean, genre writing follows a rigid formula. There's a good guy, there's a bad guy, there's a mystery. The mystery gets solved. End of story. You know, for me, honestly, crime is a matter of convenience. And I would never compare myself to people like that. What would you call, like, an American Tragedy, a crime book? You know? There's only one thing that people, there's only one story that ever gets written, and that story is trouble. You know, Isaac Bashevis Singer once said, there's only one story that anybody ever writes, and that's love. And I think love is a subdivision of trouble. So, bigger the trouble, you know, the bigger the story. I mean, if I could put on the cover of the book who did it, I would. I mean, it's no mystery who did it. You pretty quickly find out who did. I just want to get that out of the way and then get into the lives that are affected by the crime. It's not any aha type thing. I mean, in fact, people find out who did it way before the cops do.
You know, that's true, but it's also very interesting. I mean, you do sort of, it's right up front, the murder takes right up front, but you do something that at least my experience of reading the book I found fascinating, because Eric Cash, who's a witness to the crime, is essentially, you know, he's so worn down during the sort of interview period, and the police think that he's guilty, and you actually did a great job suspending my belief, because you set it up. And you make me think, okay, I think that this young man has committed the crime. But you do put a little bit of doubt in my mind that maybe somewhere later in the book there's something that's going to come up where Eric really is involved at some level. Did you do that intentionally or
not to say, well, not to suck people into any kind of mystery. The point is, there's a character in this book, this guy Eric Cash. This world of the Lower East Side for these young, mostly white kids from middle class, well-loved backgrounds. You know, they go down at 22. They're going to live forever. They're away from home. This is the place. Everywhere they look, there are people like them. And this guy, Eric Cash, who's now 35, came down there like that. And he, like all these other people, felt like, I'm going to win a Pulitzer someday. I'm going to be like Bill Gates, except cooler and less autistic. I'm with tattoos. And so it's okay, you know, I'm a waiter right now. It's okay I'm a waitress right now. You know, it's okay I do this. I'm like a bartender right now, because I'm going places. And this is a station of the cross on the way to success. So when you're 22, you're a maitre d' slash playwright, hyphen playwright, hyphen actor. You know, and all of a sudden you're 35 and the hyphen's dropped off and you're a maitre d'. There's nothing wrong with being a maitre d' if that's what you set out to be. You know, but the problem is he's surrounded by guys that are 22. He's like a school teacher. Every year you get older, but the kids keep remaining the same age. And so he's surrounded by 22-year-olds who have the same fantasies, and it drives him mad. And when he's with this kid, this 22-year-old kid, at bar hopping, when he gets shot, his first reaction is he's terrified. And he runs away. He never calls 911. The cops catch him lying, and when they think somebody's lying, they've got something to cover. They've got some bad witnesses who say he did it. So whatever the murder didn't wipe out in him in terms of like feeling anything positive about himself, the cops then eviscerate him for 8 hours in an interrogation room before they realize they goofed. You know, he didn't do it. And so you could pick up the rest of him with a dustbuster, you know. And this place, you know, it really is. 35 is the new 55, you know, down there.
Yeah, he's really at that tipping point in his life with all this, and it seems like that contributes. And it's not understood by the police that contributes a lot to sort of his mental state, because he has Ike Marcus, who's the victim in the book. You know, is sort of it's him looking back upon himself as a younger person, and that's compounded with this great sense of shame that he has for running. You know, there's this whole deal about the cell phone and why didn't he really call 911, and it all comes down to, you know, his level of shame. Now, I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about the quality of life issues, because that was a big thing with Giuliani. And I lived in New York for many years, and I distinctly remember going down to Katz's Deli, and Ludlow, right at that point going down that block, was an open heroin market. I mean, it was you know, pretty amazing to walk down there. And by the time I left in 1998, you know, it was nothing but a bunch of hipster bars, and every Saturday and Sunday night, you know, there were limos lined up. I mean, you couldn't imagine a more dramatic turnover. I'm kind of curious, though, about your feelings about the sort of the quality of life changes in the city. And I know myself, having lived in New York for a long time, you know, in the early 80s, it was a pretty rough town still. And then Giuliani came along with this quality of life initiative. And the first thing you noticed was all the panhandlers are gone from the subway. You know, we're always suspicious out here that they just bust them all to San Francisco. But But there was a double edge to that quality of life. In some sense, you know, the streets are cleaner, you know, you feel safer in the city. But also, to me, it wasn't the same city. And I guess one big issue I think of is like the Disneyfication of Times Square. Yeah. You know, Times Square used to have a surreal cruddy charm to it. And now it's really bland. Can you talk a little bit about the changes in the city?
Well, I mean, that's up to the individual, how they feel about it. I mean, would you rather have drug addicts or yuppies? You know, I mean, I don't like Times Square now either. I feel like it's all like people in sherbet-colored pants, like gaping everywhere, and you know, it's all like Lion King variations. You know, but I don't like that. But you know, on the other hand, you know, you can get romantic and nostalgic about some bad places, and this is not in defense of what's going on here. But when something's gone, all of a sudden it's beloved. You know. You had lines around the block going up to an apartment on Ludlow Street to score heroin, and that same apartment's going for $2 million. Is there a happy medium? But I don't want to be surrounded by junkies. I also don't want to be surrounded by tourists and, you know, like drunken assholes, you know, from New Jersey. I just, I'm a perfectly good New York drunken asshole, you know. I'll go to a cop bar, you know, Queens. I don't know. It's always a toss-up because it never seems like there's a middle ground, you know. It always involves it. Well, so I said real estate is violence. It always involves this tremendous uprooting of people. And, you know, the only people know about are the bad guys because they're the only ones that make the papers. You know, if you go into a housing project and, you know, this one's killed, this one's busted with 10 ounces of cocaine and this and that. You know, the kid on the Lower East Side who was going to Seward Park High School and has a B-minus average, he doesn't make the papers. So you're also getting rid of him, you know. So I don't have a solution, but I mean, and I don't think there's mixed income housing is like a nice idea, but I don't know if you're going to find enough idealists to go for that if they can afford something more exclusive. The thing about the Lower East Side, you look at it and it seems everybody says it's like a done deal. It's now like yuppie nirvana, but that place is a mess. I mean, that place is still, those housing projects are immortal, you know, and it's so schizophrenic. You walk on Clinton Street, it's not even block by block. It's like storefront by storefront. You got a Dominican nail salon right next to a preschool that, you know, that you better believe nobody in the projects is sending their kids to that preschool. There's finally, you know, white pioneers there that have had babies, you know, and it's for them. The public schools are for the others. And right next to that, you know, you have a bling shop, you know, with Jesus with ruby eyes for $25. And right next to that, you have like a little bistro hole in the wall that's got 17 tokes. And right next to that, you got a place where you can actually really get tokes. You know, but it's storefront by storefront by storefront. I mean, that place is not going to go solid for a long time.
There's also a really strange sort of falsification that takes place. I was reading a recent profile of you, and you're sitting in this bar, and I recognize, oh, it's Schiller's Liquor Store. Mm. And I had eaten there a couple years ago when I was visiting friends, and you walk into a place, and it looks like it's been there forever. And I discovered from reading this profile that everything lock, stock, and barrel was brought in elsewhere, and it was basically created to look nostalgic.
It was a stage set.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the centerpiece of the book where Eric works is this place called Berkman's, and it's based on this Keith McNally restaurant, and Keith McNally's a genius at creating atmosphere in his places. He'll create an old bistro that looks like it had Gestapo officers in there in the 40s, you know, and the partisans came and took it back, and the whole thing was like about 6 hours old. You know, I mean, he'll find the desilvered mirrors and the chicken wire glass, and you know, he'll import the pressed tin, and it's all from New Jersey, but it looks like, you know, oh, my old Jewish grandmother must have come in here. You know, no, it was a pharmacy 10 years ago.
Yeah, and the palm frites are like $12.
Yeah, well, so it's pretty cheap, but that's neither here nor there. But you know, there's a section I could read about something that happened coming sort of out of a restaurant like that.
Do you want to read that now?
Oh, okay. This is just a small monologue. There's, you know, in New York, I don't know if it's true in California. It's probably true in California. You're not allowed to smoke in restaurants or bars. And what happens in terms of, talk about quality of life, if you live near a restaurant, in a place like Lower East Side, and everybody's got to leave to smoke, and as the night gets later and later, you know, the people coming out to smoke are drunker and louder, and they're barfing, and they're horse whistling, and, you know, it'll drive the people nuts, these pitch battles, you know, with about liquor licenses and quality of life, and, you know, the attitude that restaurateurs have, people have is, we have a right to our perfect peace and quiet. And the attitude of the restaurateurs is, no, this is New York City. Nobody has perfect peace and quiet. You have a right to reasonable peace and quiet. And there, you know, so that's their, anyways, it's just like, the whole point is to take your place, put it on the market, and move to Woodstock or somewhere. There's a manhunt, sort of a half-assed manhunt, because the police realize they're never going to catch this guy, so they put a press gag on. But they're still looking for this guy, who shot this kid Ike. And one of the old Lower East Siders who doesn't know he's not supposed to be there anymore does a crime of opportunity in front of a restaurant. He snatches a bag, and when he gets grabbed by the bouncer, he says, in a panic, let me go, and I'll tell you who shot that white kid. So, of course, they ship him 3 o'clock in the morning. They ship him right down to the detective in charge of the case. And the detective's name is Maddie. His partner's name is Iacono. Iacono lives in the bunk room, comes out in shower clogs about once every 2 days. And the junkie, as you'll learn by words 3 and 4, his name is Lester Kaufman. "This city," Lester Kaufman said, one knee crossed over the other, a cuffed hand dangling languidly from the restraint bar. "People are doing so well, you know, but you can't ask them for shit anymore. It's never been so bad." Maddie grunted in sympathy. The bouncer had told Maddie that the first thing this guy had said when he grabbed him after the attempted purse snatch in front of Berkman's was, "Let me go and I'll tell you who shot that white kid." "I swear, man," Lester said to Maddie for the 10th time in the last half hour, "I just said that like in a panic, like the first thing that came into my head, what's left of my head." Unfortunately, Maddie believed him. Lester yawned like a lion, revealing a dull steel ball pierced through his tongue. Iacone, roused from sleep for this, yawned in response. "But I'll tell you, man, I'm really worried about my girlfriend. I gave her $100 to get me something, you know, get me well. She said 15 minutes and left me standing there 3 hours. I had no idea where she went, what happened to her, 15 minutes. I mean, I never would have done that if she didn't leave me there like half the night watching everybody coming out of that place for smokes, drunker and drunker, half the damn bags right on the sidewalk." Another titanic yawn, the dull, dirty tongue pierced winking. "Sucks," Iacone said. Strapped for a partner, Maddie had cajoled him out of the bunk room with the promise of overtime and an easy commute. "I mean, I'm fucked, I know it, but can you just check your computer, see if she's in the system? I'm hoping she just got collared, nothing worse, but..." "What's her name?" "Anita Castro or Colin Nieves." Iacone rose and went to the computer on Yolanda's desk. "Where'd you get $100, Lester?" Maddie asked. "Where?" He shivered, then coughed into his fist. "Oh, man, you don't want to make extra work for yourself with questions like that." "No? Seriously?" Maddie let it slide. "Nothing," Iacone called out. "Did you check Brooklyn?" Lester asked. "No, just Manhattan." "Could you check Brooklyn? She scores on South 2nd, South 3rd. No one scores in Manhattan anymore. Manhattan's dead. You guys took care of that." Lester recrossed his knees, a slice of grimy red long johns peeking out between his pale blue ankle and the cuff of his jeans. "I mean, what the hell happened to her? She was going to take me to the hospital. I have fluid in my lungs." "That's no problem. We'll get someone to take you as soon as we're finished." "Nothing," Iacone called out. "She's got a third name?" "She's not in the system, huh? Jesus, what do you think happened to her?" he asked Maddie. "And me here, this is a felony too, right?" "Not necessarily. Depends how you say what you say. You know, vis-a-vis sincerity, remorse. I am remorseful. I didn't menace. I didn't threaten. I didn't say anything. What's it, you know, terroristic?" "All right, just capture that in your statement. In fact, if you want, we can even write your statement for you. But Lester, what can I tell you that you haven't heard a million times before? You help us, we help. You think this could go down as a pet law? I picked the fucking thing up off the sidewalk. I didn't even think anybody was going to notice. When that big black guy started running after me, I was like, here, take it. I didn't even open the damn thing. I have no idea what was in there. Obviously, I'm not a pro at this. Now, don't get down on yourself, Firecone said from Yolanda's desk. You know, I got to say, right now, we're pretty much eating out of garbage cans, me and Anita. But a few years ago, we had us a store worth like $200,000. Oh, yeah? Maddie's turned to yawn. What kind of store? It was like a punk boutique? No kidding. Can I have a cigarette? Jesus, I got to get to the emergency room. All right, Maddie clapped his hands. Here we go. One time offer. Screw the guys who shot that kid. Just give us a stick-up team. Just some names. Anybody you know works the hood. They check out. Not only do you get a pass here, but we take you to the ER, get you squared away, then we go look for your girl. A stick-up team? Lester shrugged, recrossed his legs, looked away. You know, she used to use Carmen Lopez. That was like her professional name at this one place out in Massapequa. She's a bar dancer, exotic, very good, very popular, has her regulars, guys who like to see her. And she could go to their houses, some of them, borrow $30, $40, but she's 5 months pregnant now, so. Resting his brow on the curve of his free hand, I don't know, maybe it's time to go to jail. It's getting too hot out here, you know? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go to audience questions in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you a couple other things. You know, there is that word that comes out of that passage you read, terrorized. And one of the things that sort of caught my attention about this book, something I actually really admired, is that it only happens a couple years after 9/11, and yet 9/11 doesn't appear at all really in the book. I think there's maybe one reference to someone seeing that the towers are missing, noting that the towers are missing. But it was very interesting to me because it was almost as if, you know, the city itself had, you know, forget about the rest of the world and, you know, and how we've sort of turned this event into an icon and, you know, maybe used it for all kinds of bad things. But the New York seems in your book to have moved beyond that, you know, and it's in a different world. Can you reflect a little bit about the city after 9/11 and again this idea that it's not very present in this book, which actually I think is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think only 2 years afterwards it should have been more present. I think the most immediate thing that happened to the Lower East Side, the people that were mostly affected were like the Chinese immigrants, because, you know, a lot of these guys were working in restaurants that were shut down. So there was this huge financial crisis, and these guys were living, they were hanging on by a fingernail, you know, and a lot of these, you know, so, I mean, those are the jobs. I mean, people, yeah, I don't know. I didn't want to, I wanted to acknowledge it, but I didn't want it to become like a thing. I mean, I had parts of the book where people were talking, you know, more directly about, you know, immigration and stuff, but it felt like too much like gavel pounding, you know, and I took a pass on it.
Now, I'd read an interview with you, which actually this book was originally a real behemoth, and you cut 300 pages, not voluntarily. You know, was there more of that element in, let's say, the uncompleted draft?
No, I mean, the problem when going down to Lower East Side is everything I saw I thought was book worthy, you know, so it just kept getting bigger and bigger, and my editor had to come to the house and, like, sit down and talk to me in this very unthreatening voice, you know, and just lean over the laptop with me and say, look, there's the send button. Just, like, put in my email, okay, just push the send button. It's okay, just push it. It's okay. No, it's not bad. It's a good thing, you know. And it was more like an intervention than a submission. And well enough, because there were a couple of hundred pages that getting a novel out of my text was sort of like getting a, you know, like a, whatever you call a baby cow out of a mother cow. I mean, it was a mess.
Well, books like Clockers and Freedomland are a lot longer.
What is a baby cow? A calf.
A calf,
sorry.
Yes, a calf.
This big writer here.
But those other books were longer. I mean, do you feel like you had a little more? I'm always interested in the editorial
process. This is very different. See, my other two books, they were like, if you had one book in each hand, you would not need a trainer. You know, they were like Titanic. And I was happy to do it. I was, but, you know, I went like Bughouse Dickensian, you know. It's like sort of like one of the Indian novelists said, more is more, you know, pile it on, you know. And I think this book is, even though it's 400 pages, it reads like 200, because I finally got to the point in my writing life. It's like, as the older you get, the more you feel like throwing stuff away and stripping away and streamlining. And it finally got to that point in my writing career where I felt like I didn't need to say this eight different ways. One will do. And I guess maybe it was a matter of, you know, having more confidence this time out. But I just said, okay, I got it. You know, a lot of writers, they have a terrible insecurity about they're not being understood. So then they hammer something home that's been home already, and it's exhausting to the reader, and it's exhausting to the writer. But this time I managed to avoid it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to actually turn to some audience questions for a little while. As you write your novels, are you thinking about the potential film adaptation? And I wanted to add a question of my own to this. Is there any talks about Samaritan being made into a movie?
Well, I mean, I'll answer the first question first. I mean, I never think of, like, is this possibly a movie? It's like all I can do to get this thing down in the form that it's supposed to be, which is a novel. And this stuff I do is not very movie smart. I mean, a 600-page book about crack dealers, I mean, you know, yeah. Well, I mean, they did it, but I think they did it in spite of the material. It's like I never think about that. It's all I can do is just to write the novel and get down the world that I want to get. Samaritan was sold to Scott Rudin, who just basically collects me, you know. And I was supposed to write the screenplay, but he never pushed it, and I never pushed it, and money wasn't really exchanged.
I was curious about that because it's more of an internal novel at some levels,
yeah.
And it doesn't have quite as much action as, say, some of your other books. So that's why I was sort of curious whether it was going to be adapted. Could you please talk about your creative process? Do you have a routine?
Well, the creative process, it depends. You know, I'm in a million different stages. I mean, the big thing for me is to find something I want to write about. You know, that could take as long as the actual writing itself. I mean, finding something you want to make a novel out of, I mean, you're going to be with this thing for 2 or 3 years, so you better love it. And much like falling in love, it happens when it happens. So, I mean, I can go for a long time before something hits me, you know, and I get started. The only thing I can do to accelerate the process is, like, to go out into the world, into places which I think I'm interested in, and which, if I'm there, if I physically place myself there, something might gel. I mean, that being said, it's because at this point in my life, I don't really want to write autobiographical stuff. I feel like I wrote 4 novels by the time I was 31 that were all autobiographical, and even my therapist was weeping with boredom, you know. It's like, and so I learned through screenwriting that you can go out and you can learn something. There's a big world out there, you know, and you could take a bite out of that world. And as long as you get over that thing that you have to personally experience everything you write about, there's no limit to what you can write about. You can go, you can learn something. If you want to find yourself, lose yourself. I mean, for me, that's what works. I don't recommend this for anybody else, but I know when I teach writing and I have these, like, young, really bright students, it's very frustrating for them because they don't know what the hell to write about. And they say, what am I going to write about? Like, my dorm stinks. You know, I hate my parents. Thanksgiving's a drag. The girl I was going out with, you know, one of my high school senior was screwing some other guy, you know. And then I went back to this school. My roommate stinks, you know. And rightly so. They just, they run out of steam after about 2 pages, you know. And so my advice to them would be, well, get out of town. You know, go somewhere. You know, experience something. You know, and it's not just advice for young writers. You can all your life. Or the other way is, it's like, dig deep into your past. I mean, everybody's got these apocryphal stories about their family, you know. And as a writing teacher, what the most important thing I could do is, you can't teach anybody how to write any more than you can teach somebody how to run fast, you know. But you can help somebody find the story that they were meant to write. And I don't think you can even tell how good or bad a writer you are until you're writing the thing that you really want to write, you know.
And that sort of segues into the next question, which is actually one I wanted to ask myself. What was it like to go from the projects to Cornell?
Well, I mean, you don't have to understand, the projects that I came from were very functional, and it was just blue collar. I mean, it wasn't like everybody was going around walking on all fours or something, you know. I mean, it was a working class projects, and The pressure to go to, but they're very provincial. I mean, I wasn't a New Yorker. I was a Bronxite, and I could just as easily have come from Podunk to Manhattan as to come from the Bronx. I mean, we had tall buildings or relatively tall buildings, but, you know, we were not New Yorkers. To go to Cornell, actually, that's what started me on the writing path, is I felt so there was nothing around. People were from, like, really wild places, like Nashville and Rochester, New York, and Shanghai, you know, and I was kind of agog. And I think what happened is when I got there, I became more Bronx than I ever was in the Bronx. And I think that was a way of holding on to my identity. And I've seen this with other people, too. I was teaching in Binghamton in upstate New York. And there was a professor, a Faulkner professor from Mississippi. And this guy came on like Jimmy Crack Corn Snopes. And then you find out he had a PhD, that his father, growing up, was the headmaster of a private school. And I'm sure he was much more Snopesian in Binghamton, New York, than he ever was in Mississippi. But if I had to guess, I would say he got, you know, you feel like you're up to your chin in new experiences, and you got to solidify an identity for yourself. You know, people don't know the difference, except for you.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking to writer Richard Price. Here's a question about The Wire. How collaborative was the scriptwriting process on The Wire, and how did you like the process?
Well, I wouldn't have... normally, I would say I wouldn't have liked the process because it was a sort of an assembly line, but because I had, like, deep personal relationships with... I developed personal relationships with all the other writers, like David Simon and Ed Burns and Pelicanos and Lehane. You know, they're all guys I liked. And it wasn't the usual power games, or, you know, that you find in Hollywood. I mean, nobody was watching a damn show. You could do whatever you want, you know. And that's until the rise of the DVD set, which what you were talking about. You know, I never watched. It's too hard to watch an hour a week. It's too busy. It's too complex. You know, something happens in episode 3, year 2, that doesn't pay off until episode 8, year 4. How the hell are you going to watch that casually? You know, but once they came out with the season DVDs, people could actually sit down. You know, you call into work and say you're sick, and you get through seasons 1 and 2. And that's when The Wire really caught on with people. It's because, I mean, no show's ever benefited so much from the concept of a season DVD. But the process itself was David Simon and Ed Burns. They sort of created the whole notion for the show. That show was going for 2 years. They invited me in because he said it was sort of based on Clockers. It started out on Clockers, but I always kept to the trenches in Clockers. The Wire is so panoramic, it goes all the way to the Maryland State Assembly. You know, I never dared to go, you know, higher than the street. But he invited me in, and the process was you go meet some place, and, you know, you talk about, okay, what institution are we going to talk about this year? Well, let's talk about the schools. Let's talk about the drug war. Let's talk about media. Okay, what's going to happen this year to our guys? What's happening at City Hall? What's happening to Omar? What's happening to the drug corners? You know, and you rough it out, like, you know, Omar's going to go from here, and he's going to end up there 12 episodes. And then you have meetings. Let's say you're assigned episodes. I'm doing episodes 3 and 9. So I'm reading episodes 1 and 2 as they come in. Then I go down to Baltimore and I sit for two days of story meetings where everybody is going to bang out the 40 beats that'll take up the 60 minutes of episode 3. And they'll do it on index cards. But they're color-coded. Omar's orange. City Hall's blue. The police bureaucracy is yellow. Until after 2 days, you have like 36 to 45 index cards. And then you say, okay, which one? Okay, we'll start with Omar, go to City Hall, bring in the, you know, Marlo, blah, blah, blah. And so I leave Baltimore. I have an index, a stack of index cards in order and with a rubber band around it. And I go home and I flesh them out. And it's sort of like writing in a phone book, in a phone booth. I mean, there's not much wiggle room. And I have to do pretty much what everybody is expecting me to do, because as I'm writing 3, somebody's writing 4 based on what they think I'm doing. So I can't surprise anybody, and all of a sudden Omar's straight, you know, or, you know, Marlo decides, you know, he wants to be an English major, you know, and once you hand it in, David Simon's going to pretty much Simonize you. I mean, he's going to do, because he knows more than you do about the stuff. He says, you got to do the scene between the mayor and this black assemblyman in Prince George County. And the Prince George County guy is basically blackmailing the mayor to get budget funds for his schools. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that stuff. And I asked him in the meetings, well, what kind of stuff would he say? And I do my best with that. And then David will look at it and go, no, what the guy will really say. You know, and I can't. So you constantly get rewritten. And not only that, but it's your episode, but, you know, episode 2 ran long, and there's stuff they need. So they're pushing stuff out of my episode to make room for Dennis Lehane's 3 scenes that spilled over. And then Pelicanos inherits 3 scenes from my episode. So even though the moral of the story is check your ego at the door, you know. I don't think I wouldn't want to work on anything like that if it was anything else and with any other people. I mean, it's not TV, it's HBO, you know. Actually, it's not HBO, it's The Wire. You know, you open up the pay envelope and like this moth flutters out, you know.
Well, it's interesting to me because, you know, there's Richard Price, the novelist, and there's Richard Price, the screenwriter, television writer. And it seems to me, in things I've read about you, that you sort of keep them separate. But initially, was it difficult to make that jump from being a novelist to writing screenplays?
Well, yeah. Initially, you have to unlearn stuff, you know, because novelists will write the worst screenplays because their instincts are novelistic. They're four-dimensional. Characters have interior lives, and there's this thing called the narrator. There's God. I mean, the guy who's telling the story. That doesn't exist. A screenplay is a 120-page memo to a director. You know, it's a two-dimensional surface. Somebody says something, somebody does something. End of story. It's speed chess. You know, and so when I'm coming to it as a novelist, I have all my novelistic instincts and death. It's like it makes for the most turgid, long-winded movie you've ever seen. And by the same token, the very best screenwriters will write the worst novels because they're all superficial. They're all on the surface. And it's much to the credit of the novelist-turned-bad screenwriter and the screenwriter-turned-bad novelist that they're lousy in the other thing because they're good at the first thing. I mean, I don't know. There's not one major writer living today that doesn't have a screenplay in his, you know, in that little small dresser drawer that nobody knows about. And you know what? It should stay there.
Thank you. Does writing about the emotionally and socially heavy topics that you cover ever weigh on you?
No. I mean, I assume it's because you're talking about, you know, loss and poverty and drug addiction. Oh, I love that stuff. No, I mean, I don't mean to be facetious. What happens is if I go out and I see something and I embrace something, I get so caught up in the witnessing thing, you know, the natural human reaction of, like, you know, pity. It's almost like a delayed reaction, you know. I'm just trying to seize on everything, like I'm trying to like learn and understand things, you know. And you know, it weighs on me about as much as it weighs on the reader, which is to say, yes and no.
Well, it's very interesting too, because it's, you know, one of the things I get from your novels, especially, you know, let's say post The Breaks, is that there's no sense of moral superiority to any of the characters, which I find really interesting. And I also was wondering, in some sense, because you're writing about, you know, often writing about, you know, different minorities, African Americans, has anybody ever sort of taken you to task for sort of putting yourself in their eyes and in their footsteps?
Not really. I mean, you know, every once in a while, you know, somebody might say something, but the fact of the matter is, it's the job of the writer to imagine lives not your own. And nothing is, and nobody is off limits. However, I mean, if you write to a cardboard stereotype, you know, then you deserve to get blasted. But as long as you make people human beings, one of the things I was thinking about what I do is, if I'm writing about drug dealers or something like that, it's like you start out with a social monster, you know, like a drug dealer or, you know, this amoral kid who just killed somebody, doesn't think anything of it. And the progression of the book and the progression of the character is he starts out as a demon and then it's stripping away, and by the end he's a human being, you know, and I mean, that's the journey. I mean, I don't start out with a monster and then make him into a bigger monster by the end of the book. What's the point? I mean, the whole point is to humanize everybody.
Well, it all seemed to start with Strike and Clockers. And I mean, one of the things that struck me about that is you don't demonize him at all. And you really give him his real full place in that. And I was actually surprised when, you know, originally it sounded like Scorsese was going to do it, and then Spike Lee did it. And I think he did an okay job. I like a lot of his movies, but it was interesting because in some ways he, again, maybe it's that screenplay thing, but or the film sense that he made it much more surface, and you lost all this depth. You know, and there was no Vanilla Yoo-Hoo, and
well, you know, look, the thing is, it's like a movie is the author of a movie is the director. I mean, my thing is the novel. If he had shot the novel, it probably wouldn't have worked, because I mean, the worst thing a filmmaker can do is to be in awe of their source material. The great books make usually mediocre movies. Because you're doing the movie version of Catch 22. I mean, how many people have ever seen that? You know, or even like Sophie's Choice. You know, it's not particularly considered a memorable movie. Or Red Badge of Courage. You know, John Huston. I mean, Moby Dick. I mean, it certainly wasn't a Moby Dick of a movie. Mm-hmm. You know. But the point is, it's like movies have their own rules. They have their own strategies, and you cannot be too respectful of the book that your movie is based on. All you owe to the book is to be true to the spirit of it. Everything else is fair game. The other thing, I just wanted to go back to one thing. It's like taking people, a lot of these like antisocial types, for want of a better word. It's like, if you got to love every character you write. If you don't love them, no matter how heinous they are, I mean, you can't really breathe life into them, you know. And if you start out hating them, and where are you going to go with that? You know, whatever character I write, and I'm sure this is true for any other writer, it's like you love, I mean, they're yours. You created them, you know. And if you don't have that love, they're not going to make it.
Okay. We might get a couple more questions in before we have to finish up here. Who's your favorite character on The Wire, and what kind of response has The Wire gotten from the Baltimore Police Department?
Oh, well, you know, the official position of the Baltimore, my favorite character is, of course, Omar. But the Baltimore Police Department, the official position is we hate The Wire. This disrespects our city. We try to do things. The unofficial thing is there's not one cop or one police brass who does not angled to get a walk on that show, including the chief of police of Baltimore, this guy Norris, who they imported from Brooklyn. And he was a pretty good chief of police. He got the morale up, but he got in a little trouble, and he wound up going to jail. And when he came out of jail, David Simon hired him to play Detective Norris. And, you know, if you've seen the show, you know, he's one of the homicide guys. He's sort of a white, bullet-headed guy. I got to say one thing about Baltimore and The Wire in general. I was doing ride-alongs with the Baltimore police, you know, just to do it, just to see if there's anything I really needed to know about Baltimore that was so goddamn different than anywhere else. And the kids that sell drugs out there are like 13 years old, 12 years old, and they call them hoppers. You know, by 16, you're like a Korean War veteran. And so I'm with these cops, and they watch these kids. They surveil the kid, and they busted him, and they got him in a car, and he's in cuffs. He's in the back. I'm sitting in the front shotgun seat. And these kids, what happens is when you grab them, they turn into Canadian geese. Because anything you ask them, the answer is, huh? You know? And so they say, they look at the kid and they say, so Mookie, we got you dead to rights out there. And he goes, huh? And he goes, yeah, man, you're going away. You're going away forever, man. You're not coming back. Huh? You know, no matter what. And then the kid looks at me, and they all know the cops. He looks at me and he goes, who's that? And he goes, oh, Mook, you're in trouble now. This guy's a writer. He goes, huh? And he goes, yeah, he writes for The Wire. And the kid all of a sudden goes, The Wire? Why, I love The Wire. You know, I haven't seen all the episodes, but I'm hoping to catch up, you know, when the DVD comes out. Did you also perhaps write for The Corner? You know, and the cops go, wow, Mook, you like The Wire? And he goes, huh? You know, but it was like this bubble of animation. And, you know, the big thing with The Wire, which really happened, was, you know, in season two when they killed Stringer Bell, or season three, I don't even remember, all the drug – he was the poster boy for all the drug dealers in Maryland. They loved Stringer Bell because he went to community college. You know, he didn't use violence. You know, he was, like, really smart. And the wiretaps on all the drug dealers in the Baltimore and surrounding counties, the FBI wiretaps and the local police wiretaps, all they caught were these drug dealers going, they killed Stringer Bell. What the fuck is wrong with these people? That is so cold. I mean, these guys were so upset that David Simon went to the FBI and said, beg them for 15 seconds of tape. Can I just use... these guys like freaking out, and we're going to say, we're just going to play that, you know, with static on it, like an oscilloscope static, and then say, The Wire, returning September, you know. And he said, what are you kidding? It's an active case, you know.
You know, unfortunately, we're out of time now, and I apologize to not getting to all the questions from the audience. Okay. Thank you, Richard Price, for taking the time to speak to us.
You're welcome.
This program has been a part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We'd also like to thank the audience here and on the radio. I'm David Hellman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.